Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Do you all like the color blue? Yeah! I said, do you like the color blue? Yeah! 'Cause I'm here to officially declare today, November the 5th, 2019, that Virginia is officially blue. Congratulations.
Ouch. 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 That was Governor Northam on what turned out to be a shellacking of the GOP in the great state of Virginia, which once was a very proud and glorious red state. But some of us in the neighboring hinterlands of Maryland saw what happened last night coming for quite some time. Hey, everybody, I'm Michael Steele. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Yes, it's me. Post-election, I've got, you know, I'm a little bit drained. I always am after election because it's a grueling sport, particularly when you're getting your ass handed to you, as we did last night in the state of Virginia, where Democrats took not just the House, but also the Senate, and they have the governorship as well. So guess who's going to be drawing new lines in Virginia over the next couple of years? Guess who's going to be resetting the political table in Virginia? Well, Democrats are. And to help us kind of understand what happened last night, not just in Virginia, but also in Kentucky, where, dare I say, Democrats won the governorship there as well. It's none other than a dear friend, Karine Jean-Pierre. I love that. It's such a great name, strong name. She is the chief public affairs officer for Move On and an NBC and MSNBC political analyst. Yes, that means she's a collaborator with me. Ms. Jean-Pierre previously served as the deputy campaign manager for Martin O'Malley for president. I will forgive her for that. In 2011, Karine served as deputy battleground states director for President Obama's 2012 reelection campaign, managing the president's political engagement in key states while leading the delegate selection and ballot access process. So this woman knows grassroots. That's the bottom line, which is why she's going to be so perfect for this conversation. She's also the author of a great new book. And folks, you know, the personal journey is always the best one, right? When you get that moment where you get to share what it's been like to walk the walk you've walked. And she has done so with a new book that's out this week, Moving Forward, A Story of Hope, Hard Work, and the Promise of America. Karine Jean-Pierre, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you for having me, my friend. Oh, my gosh. We've been doing a lot of collaboration lately.
We have.
So this is great.
We have. You know, and
thanks
a lot
for
of,
having me on your show.
Look, a lot of my conservative friends go, yeah, I see you going to the dark side. I'm like,
The dark side. Oh, my God.
I was like, nah, baby, y'all turned out the lights long before this darkness. Trust me. y'all turned those lights out a while ago. So don't give me the dark side BS. Anyway, you had last night, and I don't want to date the podcast, but hey, this happened last night. And
It did.
The Democrats pulled it together and gave the Republicans a little bit of a black eye. How do you assess this event? Because it was. I mean, politically, it was a big deal for the Democrats to now cement their hold on Virginia. But also to reclaim the governorship in Wisconsin. And, you know, although Republicans won the attorney general's seat with an African-American Republican, a first African-American elected statewide.
First, yeah.
So as a former firstie, I welcome Cameron to the table. But governorship is bigger than attorney general, particularly.
It sure is.
Particularly when
it
that sure governor is. Was such a controversial figure, Matt Bevin, in the state of Kentucky. So give me your assessment between those two states.
Yeah, you know, I should be asking you the question, what in the world happened with your with the Republican Party? What is going on? But we can get into that. I mean, look, as you mentioned, well, in my intro, I worked for President Barack Obama in his reelection, but I also worked in 2008 for his first election, where, guess what? He won, as we all know, Virginia. And mm-hmm. that was a monumentous victory because Democrats hadn't won that stayed in some time, and it helped him get to that wonderful 270 plus that you need to need. Well, 270 that you need to reach mm-hmm. to become president, as we all know now. Look, when that happened in 2008, it was an indicator, right? It was certainly an indicator that something was happening in Virginia. And that it was changing, right? It's still very rural. It has rural voters. It has urban voters. It's a diverse state. It's one of those states. Virginia is one of those states that really Republicans needed to hold on to because of that diversity, and the rural and the urban and all of that I just stated. But it was an indicator. It was an indicator that that Virginia was trending. It was trending right. for more and more blue. And so what happened last night? Basically, it was still a swing state, a purple state. We weren't, even though it was trending. Now, just like you played with Governor Northam, it is a blue state. It is officially a blue state. And it had high turnout, right, which is what very key in those key suburban areas. And let's not forget, in 2017, when Democrats won the governorship and, you know, made some really great gains in the state legislature, we saw an indication there as well that something was happening in those suburban areas, right?
Right.
Where suburban moms were coming out. I remember the number one issue there was health care. Number two issue was actually gun reform back in 2017, and that was a clear indicator of what was going on in that state. And then last night, wow. And with going to Kentucky, let's not forget, Trump won Kentucky by 30 points.
Yeah,
30 points in 2016.
Yeah, yeah.
Democrats had no business winning that gubernatorial seat.
So,
ruby red state. And now Mitch McConnell needs to be careful.
So was that more of let's stay on Kentucky for a moment. Was that, in your estimation, more about Matt Bevin than it was Trump and the Republican brand? And I tend to fall a little bit more in that camp. I think the confluence of events helped the Democrats create the kind of surge. But there was something to be said about losing the suburbs in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. Yes, losing the suburbs in the Kentucky, like I said, a ruby red state, no business at all. And, I mean, Beshear did really well. I mean, he really overperformed in some areas. Here's the problem. Here's the problem, and this is why this is a Trump loss. As you know, he went to the state and made it all about Trump. He
right.
made it all about himself.
Right.
And he put in impeachment on the ballot. There were people wearing the red transcript, read the transcript T-shirts. He made it about himself, and yes, and Bevin turned it into a national campaign. And so that's where you're like, well, you know, this is a loss for Trump. He went down there and made it about him.
Well, and that's an interesting.
And made it about him.
Well, let's clarify that point, because I think it's important. And it really does sort of make your point, the way Governor-elect Beshear handled his moment, handled his victory. Let's take a quick listen to Trump the night before, where he was like, you know, I'm on this ballot, essentially saying, I'm on this ballot, so, you know, don't lose this because it's embarrassing to me if you lose it, versus what Beshear said last night.
Tonight, voters in Kentucky sent a message loud and clear for everyone to hear. It's a message that says our elections don't have to be about right versus left. They are still about right versus wrong.
This is a close, close race. We are not conceding this race by any stretch. Not a chance.
So at the end of that was Bevin saying, this is a close, close race. We're not conceding the race. I'm going to hold my ground. I'm going to do the Trump thing.
Trumpian, very Trumpian.
And that's okay. And that's part of the process. That ball is a fair ball. I got it. But what was interesting was the way Beshear sort of talked about this election, almost Obama-esque. It's not about a red Kentucky or a blue Kentucky. It's about the people
state,
of Kentucky.
State.
Right. And sort of keeping that sort of going. I had sent a quote into The Hill that talked about this whole idea of what you've touched on. About results like Kentucky and even in Pennsylvania, where little noted last night, for the first time since the Civil War, in one case, Republicans lost in lost control of Chester, Bucks, and Delaware County in
there.
The state of
I've
Pennsylvania.
Been to-
Right.
Yeah.
You know them well, right? As do I.
I know it well.
So for my response to all of that was the results in many respects reflect what should be, I think, a growing concern to Republicans, and that is voters. And why is that? Well, largely because it's not enough just to turn out your base anymore. And that's what Republicans need to understand, especially when you have the changing demographics and the politics of suburban communities. You can't just hold on to that. And now that Democrats are able to eat into that vote, combined with the lock they have on the urban centers that are surrounded by those suburban communities, this makes for a tough election going into 2020.
It makes for a tough election for Republicans going into 2020 because now they have to really think about things. Do they hold on to Trumpism? Do they hold on to Trump going into 2020? And that is a real question. I do want to make sure, Democrats cannot be complacent. It's going to take a movement. I say this
all
the time,
and
I have to continue. We can't be complacent. We gotta stay on top of things because I don't want people to come out after tomorrow and be like, we got this. No. It's still going to be very hard because we know what Donald Trump is going to do. Whoever is the nominee, he is going to drag their negatives up. And it is going to be that type of election. Make them corrupt, whoever the person is.
Yeah.
They're going to be corrupt. They're going to be a socialist. So anyway, but Republicans have to think about this, right? If you are right now, if you are Mitch McConnell, what are you thinking right now? What are you thinking? Cory Gardner, Susan Collins, right? What are you thinking right now? You know, if you're looking at the race in Arizona, North Carolina, like this could potentially put the Senate in play for Democrats. I mean, that's a real conversation to be had. And the Senate wasn't supposed to be something that's in play.
Well, I'm not going to poo-poo that.
Trump is.
Yeah, I'm not going to poo-poo that. There have been a number of us who have said along the way, you need to watch your back, GOP, when it comes to the Senate, because depending on how the various lanes converge, Trump being his own lane, impeachment, the economy, and any other events that occur over the course of this year, you could wind up creating a narrative in which not just the Cory Gardners and the Susan Collins of Utah and Maine, for example, being in trouble, but some other senators as well who right now are considered to be, a lock. Now, some of the data I've seen says that there are about six Republican Senate seats that are questionable on the bubble. Yes, the individual member may have a slight lead or lead strongly, but some of them are weak in their fundraising. Some of them may not have the best organizations on the ground, particularly given the turnout models that Democrats are creating and working with. So you're absolutely right that I think you've got to be a little bit more strategic in your assessment of 2020 beyond the presidential.
Yeah, I totally agree, because this should have been a very, very major red flag for Republicans, what happened last night. In particular, because we, you know, like I said, Virginia, there's been indicators like something is going on, in particular right. with 2017. That was the last big indicator, like, ooh, something is up here. And a lot of it is Trumpism. I mean, we've seen it, at least we saw that in 2017 for sure,
right.
as people were walking away from voting and telling us why they did what they did, right? And then, but Kentucky was a shock. That was a shock. You know, that should not have happened.
Right.
And so if I'm a Republican, I'm really thinking through this. And you know what else it plays into, Chairman? Not just in 2020, but how does last night play into impeachment? Right?
Cause yeah.
You know, I mean, look, the House, they are going to impeach this president. Right?
Right.
And so what happens now, it goes into trial mode, which Mitch McConnell will be in control of. And so what do they do? What do they do? And I think there's a conversation to be had, or something to be wondering about. How does this play into impeachment as well?
Yeah, that opens up an interesting Pandora's box for
yep.
Actually, ironically, the Republicans, the Democrats, mm-hmm. and Trump, because you've got three separate players who aren't all necessarily playing together.
Certainly,
the Democrats and the Republicans aren't going to play together on this. But even, let us be honest and clear, even among the, quote, Republican side of the table, Republicans and Donald Trump aren't playing well together.
Nope.
And I give you a good example just this last few days when Republicans decided, okay, so the whole no quid pro quo thing ain't working the way we thought it would work
mm-hmm.
because, oh, gee, that little pesky thing called facts are getting in the way. We'll admit that there was a quid pro quo, but it doesn't rise to the level of impeachment. And then the president comes back and goes, some people are saying that there's a quid pro quo. There was no quid pro quo.
Right,
and I'm like,
right,
dude,
right.
are you guys on the same page? You now have Gordon Sondland testifying that he made he met with Fiona Hill, who was previously served as the White House expert on Russia. Once or twice a month, and sort of going into this narrative about you know, that relationship on the heels of, you know, I guess her attorney saying that, oh, well, this was all fabricated, they barely knew each other. Well, that's not necessarily the case. So you have all these pieces that are being fitted together, Corinne, that are showing a different puzzle than the one that the administration wants us to see. And you now have that complicated, I think, further, and certainly politically, by election mm-hmm. results as we saw last night. Now, there's going to be a lot of face-saving on this. And that Republicans are already saying now that, oh, well, you know, Governor Bevin was such a bad,
it
was a bad governor. And in fact, I think he was the second worst governor in the country. But why did you send the president in there the night before?
Exactly. And that's the thing, working in the White House and you being the chairman.
You don't do that.
Of the RNC, you don't do that.
No.
If you think your guy is going to lose, guess what? You ain't going to bring the president
there. You ain't showing
there.
Up. You're not like, show you up. Send the brother
because
a postcard. Use my picture.
Right. It's like, we will do a robocall for you. Right? But we're not sending the.
This is
President
Trump.
United States. Right. It just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. And I also don't want to forget or gloss over something really important that Republicans need to think about, which is what you said, you know, that county in Pennsylvania, you know, that is a huge deal. That is a terrible sign.
Well, that's the backyard of the Republican. Again, it's, you know, these are suburbs of
it's a stronghold
of
that's,
major
that's a
urban
stronghold.
Right, and it's a stronghold for Republicans. It is the one spot that has held a lot of the various pieces together for them. And when you start losing these counties in suburban Pennsylvania, that is a telltale sign that's fraught with danger for the GOP going into 2020. What do you think the dynamic of the impeachment inquiry is right now, and how How one of the big things that I've kind of raised a number of flags about, and I'd be curious your thinking, that the public is not, they're kind of in and out of this thing. They're not engaged, but then they are. You know, the numbers are moving towards, yeah, I like the inquiry, and I'm a little bit hesitant on actual impeachment, et cetera. How do the Democrats begin to work in that space?
Yeah.
Given that they started off with crazy with, you know, Chairman Schiff saying some, you know, trying to make an analogy that didn't work. They seem to have settled down a bit. They've sort of taken my advice, and that is, you know, trust Nancy, and she's kind of reset the table a bit.
She's reset the table. She's, you know, laid out what the plans are going to be, and she has been doing also the media round, right? Making sure, like, she's been the key messenger on this. After they passed that resolution, she was everywhere. Like, she has been the messenger. She is the messenger on what is going on right now with impeachment. Look, I think the numbers, I still believe that the numbers have moved very quickly, historically very quickly. We didn't see anything like this with Nixon. It took a long time. And eventually, you know, he resigned because it was hurting the Republican Party. We're not quite seeing that yet.
Right.
But we are seeing movement in the polls. And I think next week is going to be so key because the hearings become public. And that's when I think we'll have a sense of where Democrats are with this. You know, they're starting with three folks who are going to testify in a public hearing next week. And that is, once you make this public, once people get to see for themselves, and people are going to watch.
I think they will watch.
It'll be intriguing. And they're going to at least want to know what folks are saying. And I think we can have that conversation next week or in a week or two.
How do you think Republicans handle themselves in that? Do the Jim Jordans of the world?
The problem.
Take
Jim
their jacket
Jordan
off.
Medals are so crazy. They're so insane. I think that here's the thing. The problem that they have is guess who's going to be watching the whole entire time?
Yeah.
Donald Trump.
Yeah.
You know,
so
and
they're
I think
have to,
if
they're going to show their behind, like my mama say, you're going to have to, they're going to act up for him.
Yep. And that's what they're going to do. They're going to act up and show out for him because he is going to be the one person that's going to watch it from moment A to all the way to the end. And so I think that's kind of where we are. I'm curious to see what happens. And so I don't think we know. I think the numbers, like I said, are moving in a historical fashion. You know, it's hovering like 49-50%. I mean, we just saw polls that show that people are at, 49%, close to 50% for impeach and remove?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a big movement.
Yeah,
and so because now what happens when it's public?
Right. And that's the nub of the question I'm getting to is, given the trend line that the Democrats have been successful at bringing the public along this far, where the vast majority, relatively speaking, of Americans were not for anything related to impeachment. They were sort of yawning at the thought. Have now moved into a space where, you know, 50%+ saying yes, do the investigation, 49% right on the threshold of a majority
right
are saying we not only want you to do the investigation, but if it leads to removal, then remove.
That's
important as you begin to open up the narrative further with live televised hearings.
Exactly. And those numbers are those numbers, Chairman, because without the public hearing, right?
Right.
The public hasn't even seen anything. That's
right.
The thing. That
right.
is the thing that's crazy.
And to have those individuals... do you think the Democrats are going to have lawyers do the questioning, or are the members going to do the questioning?
I think they said something. I'm trying to remember the resolution. It's in the resolution.
It's 45 minutes per...
45 minutes.
Per
and I thought they had something about staff asking. I thought I saw that, but I might be wrong.
Yeah, I think you're
that's
right.
That's a lot of time.
Yeah,
that's a lot of time.
It's a lot of time, and I think...
That's a lot of time.
Yeah, I mean, you... Yeah, and I don't know if a Jim Jordan can sustain 45 minutes of haranguing without losing credibility after the first 3 minutes of it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
it's just one of those things that you're going to find very – it's going to be television worthy, but not from the sort of reality TV perspective of Donald Trump, but I think from the history of the moment. That to me is going to be curious to see how individuals rise up to that and how they hold their own.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be it. That's why, too, if it goes into the Senate and it's a trial, that's another thing.
Right.
If it actually becomes a trial, we are going to see how each senator is going to behave and to act in that committee. And also, how are they going to, once they vote, you know, what do they say? Like, this is for the record. That's the thing. This is, they're making history, right? This is history.
Yeah.
What side of history are they going to be on?
Ah, and therein lies the question. All right, we're going to take a quick little break. As I like to tell folks, y'all, because y'all support the podcast, guess what? I got sponsors. Yay. We're going to take a moment and listen to one of them. And really appreciate you downloading and tuning in the podcast. We're going to come back with more conversation with one of my favorites, Karine Jean-Pierre. And we're going to talk about moving forward right after this. Welcome back, everybody. We're having a great conversation with Karine Jean-Pierre. She is the Chief Public Affairs Officer for Move On and an NBC and MSNBC political analyst, which means she's a colleague of mine and a good friend.
Thank you.
She has come out with a very impressive work, and it's one that I highly recommend you take the time to download or go outright buy a hard copy, but either way, get a copy of. It's called Moving Forward: A Story of Hope, Hard Work, and the Promise of America. And what I love about that title is that it touches on not just everything that is part of an immigrant narrative, but everything that is an American narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And share with us your journey, your personal journey. Tell us about it. How did it become a political one for you? Particularly given, you know, your parents coming to this country and how all that narrative has kind of turned out.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much, Chairman. You know, this is definitely, like you said, you really hit on something that is striking me right now, that's sitting heavy with me, which is, you know, it is an immigrant story. I'm an immigrant. My parents are immigrant. Both my parents are from Haiti. I was born in Martinique. I consider myself to be Haitian American. And they came to this country because everybody had told them that if you want to make change in your life, if you want opportunities, go to America. Right. Mm-hmm. And so they started off in Haiti, went to Martinique, went to France, and ended up in New York. And I grew up in Queens and also Nassau County. And they really just wanted to be part of the fabric of this country. Right. All the stories that they had heard about how immigrants and how, you know, how America is welcoming to immigrants and how you can be part of the American dream. Right. It was very elusive to them. But they were searching for it. They wanted it, and they did everything. My dad, a New York City cab driver. My mom, a home health care aide, didn't make much money, worked 6-7 days a week. You know, that story, right? That story mm-hmm. of just trying to make it. And they wanted better for me, better for their children, better for themselves. And they were knocked down a lot, like many people who are born in this country as well. Knocked down, got back right up. Knocked down, got back right up. And I wanted to tell that raw, honest story about their experience and my upbringing as well, all the ups and downs that I had in my life, because we're living in a moment right now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's been tough for immigrants in the past, and we, as a country, we have our own history that we need, complicated history that we need to deal with. But right now, in this moment, we have a president that is putting out anti-immigrant sentiment rhetoric in such an ugly way. And I wanted to tell the immigrant story of what people come here for.
Right.
You know, they don't come here to take away from people. They're taking my job. They come here because they want to give back and earn it.
Right.
They want to earn it and do better for themselves, just like everybody else. And so I wanted to tell that story in this moment And I thought it was incredibly important to be honest about that. And so that's kind of where this book led me in writing it. And also I wanted, it's also the second part of this book is indeed, take political action, a call to action, get involved. And like a call to arms in many ways for 2020, because you can't sit back in this moment. You gotta take control of your future.
Well, you say on that point, you say in the book, quote, getting involved in politics can be intimidating. If you weren't participating in debate club or Young Democrats of America, I would throw in Young Republicans as well, or Model United Nations. By the time you finished high school, I know it can feel like you have no chance in politics. That's why I'm writing this book. I'm proud of. I am proof that that's not true. I was late. I was a late bloomer. So what was that journey for you? I mean, particularly given the background of your parents, I would suspect that there were probably some conservative leanings in that regard. I mean,
absolutely.
And I won't necessarily ascribe them as Republican, but I'm saying, you know, with respect to some values or some economics,
absolutely.
You know,
socially conservative. Absolutely.
Right. So how did we scare you away when you were a young woman or did the journey just take you down a different road?
That's very funny. I think it's a combination of many things.
I'm sure.
But, you know, you make a really good point. The other thing, too, is my parents grew up in Haiti where it was a dictatorship.
Right.
You know, so politics for them was not as successful or the right thing for me as their daughter to do. They saw it as corrupt because they lived in a country that you couldn't have your political voice, your own voice. And so when I was growing up, they wanted me to be a doctor. Right?
Yes.
They wanted me to be either a doctor, a lawyer, engineer. That was very that's how they saw success.
Right.
That's how took the translation of being successful and making money and
that's
having
true for most Americans.
That's true for most Americans. And so I thought I was going to be a doctor. It didn't work out. I talk about it in details in the book. But I decided after grad school or in grad school that I was going to go into politics. My parents didn't like that. They didn't like it. I was in grad school in my mid-20s. So it's not like I came from a legacy family and, you know, knew when I was 18 that I was going to run for senator or whatever it is that for folks who are pretty much in line with their career at that age when it comes to politics. I didn't know, you know. And so when I told them that, they were incredibly disappointed. They're like, you're going to Columbia University, you got a graduate degree there, and you're going to go into politics? Are you kidding me? In their minds, you know, go ahead.
I was going to say, that sounds like my mom when I told her I decided at 17 to become a Republican. She looked at me and said, why would you want to do that? What is your problem?
And we've had that conversation.
Yeah,
I remember.
Exactly.
We've had this conversation.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's a really good story. Yeah. So when I told them that, they were like, what? Why would you do that?
What is
your
problem?
In their mind, it's corrupt. But yeah, they're like, are you going to end up dead?
Right.
Like, what does this mean? And so it took them a while to become comfortable with that.
Yeah.
And it took them really until, you know, I worked on the Obama general election in 2008, and he won, and I went to the White House, and they were like, okay, we understand that. And the other thing too, Chairman, and you know this, when you're working on a national campaign, like a presidential campaign, and you go through from one primary to another primary, or, you know, during the general election, you're living in one city or state for a week or two, another city or state for 2-3 months. You're jumping around, and that sounded crazy to them. Oh, I'm going to sleep on this, you know, the supporters offering me a couch.
Right.
I'm going to sleep on their couch. And so it didn't make any sense until we got to a place where I was able to say to her, you know, we won, and she knew we won when Obama won, and guess what? I'm going to go into the White House. And that made them proud. You know, that made them very proud that I was doing something that was such a high level to them, and that I was doing it for the first black president, which was something that was important to them. And also, you know, at the White House, where we would have, you know, be able to make change for for people like them in a serious way, which is why I went into politics. I went into politics because I went to Haiti for the first time during my, my graduate school years, and I came back wanting to make, make a difference. I started graduate school during my first week of graduate school was September 9/11, and that opened up my eyes, and I wanted to be more aware of what was going on, not just domestically, but internationally, mm-hmm. and I got to meet some international students because of the program that I was in. I came into my own and was able to figure out what is it that I was going to do with my life, with my career, and I got into politics.
How do you put in perspective, or how are you beginning to develop the framework for your own daughter to move forward?
Yeah. That's such a great question. I think about it. Yeah, I'm glad you asked. I usually talk about that organically. My daughter's five. Our daughter is 5 years old. She's amazing. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful little person. And I think about that. I mean, she, on her own, started to talk about President Trump, which is very interesting because she has her
What's
opinion.
What's going on
at
in
five.
Kindergarten, right?
What's going on? I'm like, who are you guys? What are you guys talking about at the, you know, in the playground that Donald Trump is coming up? It's very interesting.
That says so much about how deep this infection runs. I'm just telling you.
And this is the thing. Our children are listening and they're watching.
Yes.
They're listening and they're watching. And here, look at the guy that we have occupying the White House and the things that he's saying. And our children are very aware. My daughter says to me, and nothing is prompting her. She'll say, Donald Trump is a bad person. He's not a nice guy. He says mean things. And she wants to say that. She wants to talk about it. And she's five. But to your question, you know, in doing what I do, working for an organization that is part of the resistance, if you will, and having a platform on TV and writing this book, it really puts me in a position, I think, that I feel like I've gotten involved and I didn't stay quiet mm-hmm. during this time. So when my daughter's old enough to look back and to look at history and she says, well, what was going on here? What were you guys doing? Between 2015 and 2020, like what was going on? And I can say, look, I did these things. You know, I wrote a book so you can learn more about me and our history and my family and what I went through. But also I fought. I fought every day that I could to hopefully make this world a better place for you and for your friends and for young people, for kids in the future. And so that is incredibly important to me. What she learns from me, from us, from her parents, and I hope that it gives her a path for her future as well.
It's a powerful story, folks, and it's told through the eyes of an immigrant, but is expressed as an American, and it is such an important way for us, I think, to begin to rediscover our own selves, our own journey, our own families and histories, and know that in some way we all have to figure out how to move forward. And we do that with hope, we do it with hard work, and we do it with the promises of this great country in our pockets. And we all know it's not, you know, nothing's ever really promised to us that it requires those first two things, hope and hard work, to realize the promise. But it is there, and it is an opportunity for us to sort of move forward and to have some good things happen, not just for us, but for the next generation, which is what Corinne sets out in her book. And we're so glad you could take time to share it with us here on the podcast.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you. I appreciate this time. I really appreciate the friendship that we've been put together, you know, because we're both on different side of the aisles. And man, I told you this in 2010, I was like, who is this chairman of the the RNC? Oh, man, rivals.
Oh, yeah. I caught a lot of consternation over there at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, from what I understand.
Oh, yeah. It was
a good time. But you know what I love about what I do now is I get to get from behind the desk of partisanship. and engage in conversation. I've had the good fortune of being a guest in your class.
Thank you for that.
I've had the pleasure of having you come to my class as well.
Yes.
And it's always interesting. The students kind of go, like, you two actually talk to each other?
Yeah, right. That's so true.
And
we like each other.
And we like each other to boot. So it's all good. Well, the book, again, folks, is Moving Forward, A Story of Hope, Hard Work, and the Promise of America. The author is the incomparable Karine Jean-Pierre, Chief Public Affairs Officer for Move On, and a friend of mine and co-worker over at NBC and MSNBC. Thank you so much for taking time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman. I appreciate the time.
All right, folks, you know where to get this one. You got to download it. iTunes, Stitcher, all those fun places. Don't forget to get your podcast on, and we'll be back with more great conversation next time. Peace out.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.